floor of a room invaded by weeds, wrapped in the shreds of curtains that they pulled off the windows, and that fell to pieces with every turn of the body. Mémé knew where they were, because in the fright of her insomnia, she saw pass by the gentleman dressed in black, whom they delivered to the house inside a lead box on one distant Christmas Eve. And the following day, after Mass, Fernanda took her to a somber building that Mémé recognized immediately from her mother's stories of the convent where they had raised her to be a queen, and then she understood that they had come to the end of the journey. While Fernanda was speaking to someone in the office next door, Mémé remained in her parlor, checkered with large oil paintings of colonial archbishops, still wearing an étamine dress with small black flowers and stiff high shoes which were swollen by the cold of the uplands. She was standing in the center of the parlor, thinking about Mauricio Babilonia under the yellow stream of light from the stained glass windows, when a very beautiful novice came out of the office, carrying her suitcase with the three changes of clothing. As she passed Mémé, she took her hand without stopping.
"Come, Renata," she said to her.
Mémé took her hand and let herself be led. The last time that Fernanda saw her, trying to keep up with the novice, the iron grating of the cloister had just closed behind her. She was still thinking about Mauricio Babilonia, his smell of grease and his halo of butterflies, and she would keep on thinking about him for all the days of her life, until the remote autumn morning when she died of old age, with her name changed and her head shaved, and without ever having spoken a word, in a gloomy hospital in Krakow. Fernanda returned to Macondo on a train protected by armed police. During the trip she noticed the tension of the passengers, the military preparations in the towns along the line, and an atmosphere rarefied by the certainty that something serious was going to happen. But she had no information until she reached Macondo, and they told her that José Arcadio Segundo was inciting the workers of the banana company to strike. "That's all we need," Fernanda said to herself, "an anarchist in the family." The strike broke out 2 weeks later, and it did not have the dramatic consequences that had been feared. The workers demanded that they not be obliged to cut and load bananas on Sundays, and the position seemed so just that even Father Antonio Isabel interceded in its favor, because he found it in accordance with the laws of God. That victory, along with other actions that were initiated during the following months, drew the colorless José Arcadio Segundo out of his anonymity, for people had been accustomed to say that he was only good for filling up the town with French whores. With the same impulsive decision with which he had auctioned off his fighting cocks in order to organize a hare-brained boat business, he gave up his position as foreman in the banana company and took the side of the workers. Quite soon he was pointed out as the agent of an international conspiracy against public order. One night, during the course of a week darkened by somber rumors, he miraculously escaped four revolver shots taken at him by an unknown party as he was leaving a secret meeting. The atmosphere of the following months was so tense that even Ursula perceived it in her dark corner, and she had the impression that once more she was living through the dangerous times, when her son Aureliano carried the homeopathic pills of subversion in his pocket. She tried to speak to José Arcadio Segundo, to let him know about that precedent, but Aureliano Segundo told her that since the night of the attempt on his life, no one knew his whereabouts. "Just like Aureliano," Ursula exclaimed. "It's as if the world were repeating itself." Fernando was immune to the uncertainty of those days. She had no contact with the outside world since the violent altercation she had had with her husband, over her having decided Mémé's fate without his consent. Aureliano Segundo was prepared to rescue his daughter with the help of the police, if necessary. But Fernanda showed him some papers that were proof that she had entered the convent of her own free will. Mémé had indeed signed, once she was already behind the iron grating, and she did it with the same indifference with which she had allowed herself to be led away. Underneath it all, Aureliano Segundo did not believe in the legitimacy of the proof, just as he never believed that Mauricio Babilonia had gone into the yard to steal chickens. But both expedients served to ease his conscience, and thus he could go back without remorse under the shadow of Petracotes, where he revived his noisy revelry and unlimited gormandizing. Foreign to the restlessness of the town, deaf to Ursula's quiet predictions, Fernanda gave the last turn to the screw of her preconceived plan. She wrote a long letter to her son, José Arcadio, who was then about to take his first orders, and in it she told him that his sister Renata had expired in the peace of the Lord, and as a consequence of the black vomit. Then she put Amaranta Ursula under the care of Santa Sofia de la Piedad, and dedicated herself to organizing her correspondence with the invisible doctors, which had been upset by Meme's trouble. The first thing that she did was to set a definite date for the postponed telepathic operation. But the invisible doctors answered her that it was not wise so long as the state of social agitation continued in Macondo. She was so urgent and so poorly informed that she explained to them in another letter that there was no such state of agitation, and that everything was the result of the lunacy of a brother-in-law of hers, who was fiddling around at that time in that labor union nonsense, just as he had been involved with cock-fighting and riverboats before. They were still not in agreement on the hot Wednesday when an aged nun knocked at the door, bearing a small basket on her arm. When she opened the door, Santa Sofia de la Piedad thought that it was a gift, and tried to take the small basket that was covered with a lovely lace wrap. But the nun stopped her, because she had instructions to give it personally, and with the strictest secrecy, to Doña Fernanda del Carpio de Buendía. It was Meme's son. Fernanda's former spiritual director explained to her in a letter that he had been born 2 months before, and that they had taken the privilege of baptizing him Aureliano, for his grandfather, because his mother would not open her lips to tell them her wishes. Fernanda rose up inside against that trick of fate, but she had sufficient strength to hide it in front of the nun. "We'll tell them that we found him floating in the basket," she said, smiling. "No one will believe it," the nun said. "If they believe it in the Bible," Fernanda replied, "I don't see why they shouldn't believe it from me." The nun lunched at the house while she waited for the train back, and in accordance with the discretion they asked of her, she did not mention the child again. But Fernanda viewed her as an undesirable witness of her shame, and lamented the fact that they had abandoned the medieval custom of hanging a messenger who bore bad news. It was then that she decided to drown the child in the cistern as soon as the nun left, but her heart was not strong enough, and she preferred to wait patiently until the infinite goodness of God would free her from the annoyance. The new Aureliano was a year old when the tension of the people broke with no forewarning. José Arcadio II and other union leaders, who had remained underground until then, suddenly appeared one weekend and organized demonstrations in towns throughout the banana region. The police merely maintained public order, but on Monday night the leaders were taken from their homes and sent to jail in the capital of the province, with 2-pound irons on their legs. Taken among them were José Arcadio II and Lorenzo Gavilán, a colonel in the Mexican Revolution, exiled in Macondo, who said that he had been witness to the heroism of his comrade Artemio Cruz. They were set free, however, within 3 months, because of the fact that the government and the banana company could not reach an agreement as to who should feed them in jail. The protests of the workers this time were based on the lack of sanitary facilities in their living quarters, the non-existence of medical services, and terrible working conditions. They stated, furthermore, that they were not being paid in real money but in scrip, which was good only to buy Virginia ham in the company commissaries. José Arcadio II was put in jail because he revealed that the scrip system was a way for the company to finance its fruit ships, which, without the commissary merchandise, would have to return empty from New Orleans to the banana ports. The other complaints were common knowledge. The company physicians did not examine the sick, but had them line up behind one another in the dispensaries, and a nurse would put a pill the color of copper sulfate on their tongues, whether they had malaria, gonorrhea, or constipation. It was a cure that was so common that children would stand in line several times, and instead of swallowing the pills, would take them home to use as bingo markers. The company workers were crowded together in miserable barracks. The engineers, instead of putting in toilets, had a portable latrine for every 50 people brought to the camps at Christmas time, and they held public demonstrations of how to use them so that they would last longer. The decrepit lawyers dressed in black, who during other times had besieged Colonel Aureliano Buendía, and who now were controlled by the banana company, dismissed those demands with decisions that seemed like acts of magic. When the workers drew up a list of unanimous petitions, a long time passed before they were able to notify the banana company officially. As soon as he found out about the agreement, Mr. Brown hitched his luxurious, glass-stained coach to the train and disappeared from Macondo, along with the more prominent representatives of his company. Nonetheless, some workers found one of them the following Saturday in a brothel, and they made him sign a copy of the sheet with the demands, while he was naked with the women who had helped to entrap him. The mournful lawyers showed in court that the man had nothing to do with the company, and in order that no one doubt their arguments, they had him jailed as an impostor. Later on, Mr. Brown was surprised, travelling incognito in a third-class coach, and they made him sign another copy of the demands. On the following day he appeared before the judges with his hair dyed black and speaking flawless Spanish. The lawyers showed that the man was not Mr. Jack Brown, the superintendent of the banana company, born in Prattville, Alabama, but a harmless vendor of medicinal plants, born in Macondo, and baptized there with the name of Dagoberto Fonseca. A while later, faced with a new attempt by the workers, the lawyers publicly exhibited Mr. Brown's death certificate, attested to by consuls and foreign ministers, which bore witness that on June 9th last, he had been run over by a fire engine in Chicago. Tired of that hermeneutical delirium, the workers turned away from the authorities in Macondo and brought their complaints up to the higher courts. It was there that the sleight-of-hand lawyers proved that the demands lacked all validity, for the simple reason that the banana company did not have, never had had, and never would have, any workers in its service, because they were all hired on a temporary and occasional basis. So that the fable of the Virginia ham was nonsense, the same as that of the miraculous pills and the Yuletide toilets, and by a decision of the court it was established and set down in solemn decrees that the workers did not exist. The great strike broke out. Cultivation stopped halfway, the fruit rotted on the trees, and the 120-car trains remained on the sidings. The idle workers overflowed the towns. The Street of the Turks echoed with a Saturday that lasted for several days, and in the pool room at the Hotel Jacob, they had to arrange 24-hour shifts. That was where José Arcadio Segundo was on the day it was announced that the army had been assigned to re-establish public order. Although he was not a man given to omens, the news was like an announcement of death that he had been waiting for ever since that distant morning when Colonel Gerineldo Márquez had let him see an execution. The bad omen did not change his solemnity, however. He took the shot he had planned, and it was good. A short time later, the drumbeats, the shrill of the bugle, the shouting and running of the people, told him that not only had the game of pool come to an end, but also the silent and solitary game that he had been playing with himself ever since that dawn execution. Then he went out into the street and saw them. There were three regiments, whose march in time to a galley drum made the earth tremble. Their snorting of a many-headed dragon filled the glow of noon with a pestilential vapour. They were short, stocky, and brute-like. They perspired with the sweat of a horse, and had a smell of sun-tanned hide and the taciturn and impenetrable perseverance of men from the uplands. Although it took them over an hour to pass by, one might have thought that they were only a few squads marching in a circle, because they were all identical, sons of the same bitch, and with the same stolidity they all bore the weight of their packs and canteens, the shame of their rifles with fixed bayonets, and the chancre of blind obedience and a sense of honour. Ursula heard them pass from her bed in the shadows, and she made a cross with her fingers. Santa Sofia de la Piedad existed for an instant, leaning over the embroidered tablecloth that she had just ironed, and she thought of her son, José Arcadio Segundo, who without changing expression watched the last soldiers pass by the door of the Hotel Jacob. Martial law enabled the army to assume the functions of arbitrator in the controversy, but no effort at conciliation was made. As soon as they appeared in Macondo, the soldiers put aside their rifles and cut and loaded the bananas and started the trains running. The workers, who had been content to wait until then, went into the woods with no other weapons but their working machetes, and they began to sabotage the sabotage. They burned plantations and commissaries, tore up tracks to impede the passage of the trains that began to open their path with machine gun fire, and they cut telegraph and telephone wires. The irrigation ditches were stained with blood. Mr. Brown, who was alive in the electrified chicken coop, was taken out of Macondo with his family and those of his fellow countrymen and brought to a safe place under the protection of the army. The situation was threatening to lead to a bloody and unequal civil war when the authorities called upon the workers to gather in Macondo. The summons announced that the civil and military leader of the province would arrive on the following Friday, ready to intercede in the conflict. José Arcadio Segundo was in the crowd that had gathered at the station on Friday since early in the morning. He had taken part in a meeting of union leaders and had been commissioned, along with Colonel Gavilán, to mingle in the crowd and orient it according to how things went. He did not feel well, and a salty paste was beginning to collect on his palate when he noticed that the army had set up machine gun emplacements around the small square and that the wired city of the Banana Company was protected by artillery pieces. Around 12 o'clock, waiting for a train that was not arriving, more than 3,000 people, workers, women, and children, had spilled out of the open space in front of the station and were pressing into the neighboring streets, which the army had closed off with rows of machine guns. At that time it all seemed more like a jubilant fair than a waiting crowd. They had brought over the fritter and drink stands from the Street of the Turks, and the people were in good spirits as they bore the tedium of waiting and the scorching sun. A short time before 3 o'clock, the rumor spread that the official train would not arrive until the following day. The crowd let out a sigh of disappointment. An army lieutenant then climbed up onto the roof of the station, where there were 4 machine gun emplacements aiming at the crowd, and called for silence. Next to José Arcadio Segundo, there was a barefooted woman, very fat, with 2 children between the ages of 4 and 7. She was carrying the smaller one, and she asked José Arcadio Segundo, without knowing him, if he would lift up the other one so that he could hear better. José Arcadio Segundo put the child on his shoulders. Many years later, that child would still tell, to the disbelief of all, that he had seen the lieutenant reading Decree No. 4 of the civil and military leader of the province through an old phonograph horn. It had been signed by General Carlos Cortes Vargas and his secretary, Major Enrique García Isaza, and in 3 articles of 80 words, he declared the strikers to be a bunch of hoodlums, and he authorized the army to shoot to kill. After the decree was read, in the midst of a deafening hoot of protest, a captain took the place of the lieutenant on the roof of the station, and with the horn, he signaled that he wanted to speak. The crowd was quiet again. "Ladies and gentlemen," the captain said in a low voice that was slow and a little tired, "you have 5 minutes to withdraw." The redoubled hooting and shouting drowned out the bugle call that announced the start of the count. No one moved. 5 minutes have passed," the captain said in the same tone. "One more minute and we'll open fire." José Arcadio Segundo, sweating ice, lowered the child and gave him to the woman. "Those bastards might just shoot," she murmured. José Arcadio Segundo did not have time to speak, because at that instant he recognized the hoarse voice of Colonel Gavilán echoing the words of the woman with a shout. Intoxicated by the tension, by the miraculous depth of the silence, and furthermore convinced that nothing could move that crowd, held tight in a fascination with death, José Arcadio Segundo raised himself up over the heads in front of him, and for the first time in his life, he raised his voice. "You bastards!" he shouted. "Take the extra minute and stick it up your ass!" After his shout, something happened that did not bring on fright, but a kind of hallucination. The captain gave the order to fire, and 14 machine guns answered at once. But it all seemed like a farce. It was as if the machine guns had been loaded with caps. Because their panting rattle could be heard, and their incandescent spitting could be seen, but not the slightest reaction was perceived, not a cry, not even a sigh among the compact crowd that seemed petrified by an instantaneous invulnerability. Suddenly, on one side of the station, a cry of death tore open the enchantment.
"Ah, mother!"
A seismic voice, a volcanic breath, the roar of a cataclysm broke out in the center of the crowd with a great potential of expansion. José Arcadio Segundo barely had time to pick up the child, while the mother with the other one was swallowed up by the crowd that swirled about in panic. Many years later, that child would still tell, in spite of people thinking that he was a crazy old man, how José Arcadio Segundo had lifted him over his head and hauled him almost in the air, as if floating on the terror of the crowd, toward a nearby street. The child's privileged position allowed him to see, at that moment, that the wild mass was starting to get to the corner and the row of machine guns opened fire. Several voices shouted at the same time, "Get down! Get down!" The people in front had already done so, swept down by the wave of bullets. The survivors, instead of getting down, tried to go back to the small square, and the panic became a dragon's tail, as one compact wave ran against another, which was moving in the opposite direction, toward the other dragon's tail in the street across the way, where the machine guns were also firing without cease. They were penned in, swirling about in a gigantic whirlwind that little by little was being reduced to its epicenter, as the edges were systematically being cut off all around, like an onion being peeled by the insatiable and methodical shears of the machine guns. The child saw a woman kneeling with her arms in the shape of a cross in an open space, mysteriously free of the stampede. José Arcadio Segundo put him up there at the moment he fell, with his face bathed in blood, before the colossal troop wiped out the empty space, the kneeling woman, the light of the high, drought-stricken sky, and the whorish world where Ursula Iguaran had sold so many little candy animals. When José Arcadio Segundo came to, he was lying face up in the darkness. He realized that he was riding on an endless and silent train, and that his head was caked with dry blood, and that all his bones ached. He felt an intolerable desire to sleep. Prepared to sleep for many hours, safe from the terror and the horror, he made himself comfortable on the side that pained him less, and only then did he discover that he was lying against dead people. There was no free space in the car except for an aisle in the middle. Several hours must have passed since the massacre, because the corpses had the same temperature as plaster in autumn, and the same consistency of petrified foam that it had, and those who had put them in the car had had time to pile them up in the same way in which they transported bunches of bananas. Trying to flee from the nightmare, José Arcadio Segundo dragged himself from one car to another in the direction in which the train was heading, and in the flashes of light that broke through the wooden slats as they went through sleeping towns, he saw the man corpses, woman corpses, child corpses, who would be thrown into the sea like rejected bananas. He recognized only a woman who sold drinks in the square, and Colonel Gavilan, who still held wrapped in his hand the belt with a buckle of Morelia silver with which he had tried to open his way through the panic. When he got to the first car, he jumped into the darkness and lay beside the tracks until the train had passed. It was the longest one he had ever seen, with almost 200 freight cars, and a locomotive at either end, and a third one in the middle. It had no lights, not even the red and green running lights, and it slipped off with a nocturnal and stealthy velocity. On top of the cars there could be seen the dark shapes of the soldiers with their emplaced machine guns. After midnight, a torrential cloudburst came up. José Arcadio Segundo did not know where it was that he had jumped off, but he knew that by going in the opposite direction to that of the train he would reach Macondo. After walking for more than 3 hours, soaked to the skin, with a terrible headache, he was able to make out the first houses in the light of dawn. Attracted by the smell of coffee, he went into a kitchen where a woman with a child in her arms was leaning over the stove. "Hello," he said, exhausted. "I'm José Arcadio Segundo Buendía." He pronounced his whole name, letter by letter, in order to convince her that he was alive. He was wise in doing so, because the woman had thought that he was an apparition, as she saw the dirty, shadowy figure, with his head and clothing dirty with blood, and touched with the solemnity of death, come through the door. She recognized him. She brought him a blanket so that he could wrap himself up while his clothes dried by the fire. She warmed some water to wash his wound, which was only a flesh wound, and she gave him a clean diaper to bandage his head. Then she gave him a mug of coffee without sugar, as she had been told the Buendías drank it, and she spread his clothing out near the fire. José Arcadio Segundo did not speak until he had finished drinking his coffee. "There must have been 3,000 of them," he murmured. "What? The dead?" he clarified. "It must have been all of the people who were at the station." The woman measured him with a pitying look. "There haven't been any dead here," she said. Since the time of your uncle, the colonel, nothing has happened in Macondo. In the three kitchens where Jose Arcadio Segundo stopped before reaching home, they told him the same thing. There weren't any dead. He went through the small square by the station, and he saw the fritter stands piled one on top of the other, and he could find no trace of the massacre. The streets were deserted under the persistent rain, and the houses locked up with no trace of life inside. The only human note was the first tolling of the bells for mass. He knocked at the door at Colonel Gavilan's house. A pregnant woman, whom he had seen several times, closed the door in his face.
"He left," she said, frightened. "He went back to his own country."
The main entrance to the wire chicken coop was guarded, as always, by two local policemen, who looked as if they were made of stone under the rain, with raincoats and rubber boots. On their marginal street, the West Indian Negroes were singing their Saturday psalms. Jose Arcadio Segundo jumped over the courtyard wall and entered the house through the kitchen. Santa Sofia de la Piedad barely raised her voice.
"Don't let Fernanda see you," she said. "She's just getting up."
As if she were fulfilling an implicit pact, she took her son to the chamber pot room, arranged Melquiades' broken-down cot for him, and at 2 in the afternoon, while Fernando was taking her siesta, she passed a plate of food into him through the window. Aureliano Segundo had slept at home because the rain had caught him there, and at 3 in the afternoon he was still waiting for it to clear. Informed in secret by Santa Sofia de la Piedad, he visited his brother in Melquiades' room at that time. He did not believe the version of the massacre or the nightmare trip of the train loaded with corpses traveling toward the sea either. The night before he had read an extraordinary proclamation to the nation which said that the workers had left the station and had returned home in peaceful groups. The proclamation also stated that the union leaders, with great patriotic spirit, had reduced their demands to 2 points, a reform of medical services and the building of latrines in the living quarters. It was stated later that when the military authorities obtained the agreement with the workers, they hastened to tell Mr. Brown, and he not only accepted the new conditions, but offered to pay for 3 days of public festivities to celebrate the end of the conflict. Except that when the military asked him on what date they could announce the signing of the agreement, he looked out the window at the sky, crossed with lightning flashes, and made a profound gesture of doubt. "When the rain stops," he said, "as long as the rain lasts, we're suspending all activities." It had not rained for 3 months, and there had been a drought, but when Mr. Brown announced his decision, a torrential downpour spread over the whole banana region. It was the one that caught Jose Arcadio Segundo on his way to Macondo. A week later it was still raining. The official version, repeated 1,000 times and mangled out all over the country by every means of communication the government found at hand, was finally accepted. There were no dead. The satisfied workers had gone back to their families, and the banana company was suspending all activity until the rains stopped. Martial law continued with an eye to the necessity of taking emergency measures for the public disaster of the endless downpour, but the troops were confined to quarters. During the day, the soldiers walked through the torrents in the streets with their pant legs rolled up, playing with boats with the children. At night, after taps, they knocked doors down with their rifle butts, hauled suspects out of their beds, and took them off on trips from which there was no return. The search for and extermination of the hoodlums, murderers, arsonists, and rebels of Decree No. 4 was still going on, but the military denied it even to the relatives of the victims, who crowded the commandant's offices in search of news. "You must have been dreaming," the officers insisted. "Nothing has happened in Macondo, nothing has ever happened, and nothing ever will happen. This is a happy town." In that way they were finally able to wipe out the union leaders. The only survivor was Jose Arcadio Segundo. One February night, the unmistakable blows of rifle butts were heard at the door. Aureliano Segundo, who was still waiting for it to clear, opened the door to 6 soldiers under the command of an officer. Soaking from the rain, without saying a word, they searched the house room by room, closet by closet, from parlor to pantry. Ursula woke up when they turned on the light in her room, and she did not breathe while the search went on, but held her fingers in the shape of a cross, pointing them to where the soldiers were moving about. Santa Sofia de la Piedad managed to warn Jose Arcadio Segundo, who was sleeping in Melquiades' room, but he could see that it was too late to try to escape. So, Santa Sofia de la Piedad locked the door again, and he put on his shirt and his shoes and sat down on the cot to wait for them. At that moment they were searching the gold workshop. The officer made them open the padlock, and with a quick sweep of his lantern, he saw the workbench and the glass cupboard with bottles of acid and instruments that were still where their owner had left them, and he seemed to understand that no one lived in that room. He wisely asked Aureliano Segundo if he was a silversmith, however, and the latter explained to him that it had been Colonel Aureliano Buendia's workshop.
"Oh,"
the officer said, turned on the lights, and ordered such a minute search that they did not miss the 18 little gold fishes that had not been melted down, and that were hidden behind the bottles in their tin can. The officer examined them one by one on the workbench, and then he turned human.
"I'd like to take one, if I may," he said. "At one time they were a mark of subversion, but now they're relics."
He was young, almost an adolescent, with no sign of timidity and with a natural, pleasant manner that had not shown itself until then. Aureliano Segundo gave him the little fish. The officer put it in his shirt pocket with a childlike glow in his eyes, and he put the others back in the can and set it back where it had been.
"It's a wonderful memento," he said.
"Colonel Aureliano Buendia was one of our greatest men." Nevertheless, that surge of humanity did not alter his professional conduct. At Melquiades' room, which was locked up again with the padlock, Santa Sofia de la Piedad tried one last hope.
"No one has lived in that room for a century," she said.
The officer had it opened and flashed the beam of the lantern over it, and Aureliano Segundo and Santa Sofia de la Piedad saw the Arab eyes of José Arcadio Segundo at the moment when the ray of light passed over his face, and they understood that it was the end of one anxiety and the beginning of another, which would find relief only in resignation. But the officer continued examining the room with the lantern, and showed no sign of interest, until he discovered the 72 chamber pots piled up in the cupboards. Then he turned on the light. José Arcadio Segundo was sitting on the edge of the cot, ready to go, more solemn and pensive than ever. In the background were the shelves with the shredded books, the rolls of parchment, and the clean and orderly work table, with the ink still fresh in the inkwells. There was the same pureness in the air, the same clarity, the same respite from dust and destruction that Aureliano Segundo had known in childhood, and that only Colonel Aureliano Buendia could not perceive. But the officer was only interested in the chamber pots.
"How many people live in this house?" he asked.
"Five."
The officer obviously did not understand. He paused with his glance on the space where Aureliano Segundo and Santa Sofia de la Piedad were still seeing José Arcadio Segundo, and the latter also realized that the soldier was looking at him without seeing him. Then he turned out the light and closed the door. When he spoke to the soldiers, Aureliano Segundo understood that the young officer had seen the room with the same eyes as Colonel Aureliano Buendia. "It's obvious that no one has been in that room for at least 100 years, the officer said to the soldiers. "There must even be snakes in there." When the door closed, José Arcadio Segundo was sure that the war was over. Years before, Colonel Aureliano Buendia had spoken to him about the fascination of war, and had tried to show it to him with countless examples drawn from his own experience. He had believed him, but the night when the soldiers looked at him without seeing him, while he thought about the tension of the past few months, the misery of jail, the panic at the station, and the train loaded with dead people, José Arcadio Segundo reached the conclusion that Colonel Aureliano Buendia was nothing but a faker or an imbecile. He could not understand why he had needed so many words to explain what he felt in war, because one was enough. Fear. In Melquiades' room, on the other hand, protected by the supernatural light, by the sound of the rain, by the feeling of being invisible, he found the repose that he had not had for one single instant during his previous life, and the only fear that remained was that they would bury him alive. He told Santa Sofia de la Piedad about it when she brought him his daily meals, and she promised to struggle to stay alive even beyond her natural forces in order to make sure that they would bury him dead. Free from all fear, José Arcadio Segundo dedicated himself then to peruse the manuscripts of Melquiades many times, and with so much more pleasure when he could not understand them. He became accustomed to the sound of the rain, which after 2 months had become another form of silence, and the only thing that disturbed his solitude was the coming and going of Santa Sofia de la Piedad. He asked her, therefore, to leave the meals on the windowsill and padlock the door. The rest of the family forgot about him, including Fernanda, who did not mind leaving him there when she found that the soldiers had seen him without recognizing him. After 6 months of enclosure, since the soldiers had left Macondo, Aureliano Segundo removed the padlock, looking for someone he could talk to until the rain stopped. As soon as he opened the door, he felt the pestilential attack of the chamber pots, which were placed on the floor and all of which had been used several times. José Arcadio Segundo, devoured by baldness, indifferent to the air that had been sharpened by the nauseating vapors, was still reading and rereading the unintelligible parchments. He was illuminated by a seraphic glow. He scarcely raised his eyes when he heard the door open, but that look was enough for his brother to see repeated in it the irreparable fate of his great-grandfather. "There were more than 3,000 of them," was all that José Arcadio Segundo said. "I'm sure now that they were everybody who had been at the station." It rained for 4 years, 11 months, and 2 days. There were periods of drizzle during which everyone put on his full dress and a convalescent look to celebrate the clearing, but people soon grew accustomed to interpret the pauses as a sign of redoubled rain. The sky crumbled into a set of destructive storms, and out of the north came hurricanes that scattered roofs about, and knocked down walls and uprooted every last plant of the banana groves. Just as during the insomnia plague, as Ursula came to remember during those days, the calamity itself inspired defenses against boredom. Aureliano Segundo was one of those who worked hardest not to be conquered by idleness. He had gone home for some minor matter on the night that Mr. Brown unleashed the storm, and Fernanda tried to help him with a half-blown-out umbrella that she found in a closet. "I don't need it," he said. "I'll stay until it clears." That was not, of course, an ironclad promise, but he would accomplish it literally. Since his clothes were at Petrakotis's, every 3 days he would take off what he had on and wait in his shorts until they were washed. In order not to become bored, he dedicated himself to the task of repairing the many things that needed fixing in the house. He adjusted hinges, oiled locks, screwed knockers tight, and planed door jams. For several months he was seen wandering about with a toolbox that the gypsies must have left behind in José Arcadio Buendía's days, and no one knew whether, because of the involuntary exercise, the winter tedium, or the imposed abstinence, but his belly was deflating little by little like a wineskin, and his face, of a beatific tortoise, was becoming less bloodshot, and his double chin less prominent, until he became less pachydermic all over and was able to tie his own shoes again. Watching him putting in latches and repairing clocks, Fernando wondered whether or not he too might be falling into the vice of building so that he could take a part, like Colonel Aureliano Buendía and his little gold fishes, Amaranta and her shroud and her buttons, José Arcadio and the parchments, and Ursula and her memories. But that was not the case. The worst part was that the rain was affecting everything, and the driest of machines would have flowers popping out among their gears if they were not oiled every 3 days, and the threads in brocades rusted, and wet clothing would break out in a rash of saffron-coloured moss. The air was so damp that fish could have come in through the doors and swum out the windows, floating through the atmosphere in the rooms. One morning Ursula woke up feeling that she was reaching her end in a placid swoon, and she had already asked them to take her to Father Antonio Isabel, even if it had to be on a stretcher, when Santa Sofia de la Piedad discovered that her back was paved with leeches. She took them off one by one, crushing them with a firebrand before they bled her to death. It was necessary to dig canals to get the water out of the house and rid it of the frogs and snails, so that they could dry the floors and take the bricks from under the bedposts and walk in shoes once more. Occupied with the many small details that called for his attention, Aureliano Segundo did not realize that he was getting old, until one afternoon when he found himself contemplating the premature dusk from a rocking chair, and thinking about Petrakotis, without quivering. There would have been no problem in going back to Fernanda's insipid love, because her beauty had become solemn with age. But the rain had spared him from all emergencies of passion, and had filled him with the spongy serenity of a lack of appetite. He amused himself thinking about the things that he could have done in other times with that rain, which had already lasted a year. He had been one of the first to bring zinc sheets to Macondo, much earlier than their popularization by the banana company, simply to roof Petra Cortes's bedroom with them, and to take pleasure in the feeling of deep intimacy that the sprinkling of the rain produced at that time. But even those wild memories of his mad youth left him unmoved, just as during his last debauch he had exhausted his quota of salaciousness, and all he had left was the marvelous gift of being able to remember it without bitterness or repentance. It might have been thought that the deluge had given him the opportunity to sit and reflect, and that the business of the pliers and the oil can had awakened in him the tardy yearning of so many useful trades that he might have followed in his life and did not. But neither case was true, because the temptation of a sedentary domesticity that was besieging him was not the result of any rediscovery or moral lesson. It came from much farther off, unearthed by the rain's pitchfork from the days when, in Melquiades' room, he would read the prodigious fables about flying carpets and whales that fed on entire ships and their crews. It was during those days that, in a moment of carelessness, little Aureliano appeared on the porch, and his grandfather recognized the secret of his identity. He cut his hair, dressed him, taught him not to be afraid of people, and very soon it was evident that he was a legitimate Aureliano Buendía, with his high cheekbones, his startled look, and his solitary air. It was a relief for Fernanda. For some time she had measured the extent of her pridefulness, but she could not find any way to remedy it, because the more she thought of solutions, the less rational they seemed to her. If she had known that Aureliano Segundo was going to take things the way he did, with the fine pleasure of a grandfather, she would not have taken so many turns or got so mixed up, but would have freed herself from mortification the year before. Amaranta Ursula, who already had her second teeth, thought of her nephew as a scurrying toy, who was a consolation for the tedium of the rain. Aureliano Segundo remembered then the English encyclopedia that no one had since touched in Meme's old room. He began to show the children the pictures, especially those of animals, and later on the maps and photographs of remote countries and famous people. Since he did not know any English and could identify only the most famous cities and people, he would invent names and legends to satisfy the children's insatiable curiosity. Fernanda really believed that her husband was waiting for it to clear to return to his concubine. During the first months of the rain, she was afraid that he would try to slip into her bedroom, and that she would have to undergo the shame of revealing to him that she was incapable of reconciliation since the birth of Amaranta Ursula. That was the reason for her anxious correspondence with the invisible doctors, interrupted by frequent disasters of the mail. During the first months, when it was learned that the trains were jumping their tracks in the rain, a letter from the invisible doctors told her that hers were not arriving. Later on, when contact with the unknown correspondents was broken, she had seriously thought of putting on the tiger mask that her husband had worn in the bloody carnival and having herself examined under a fictitious name by the banana company doctors. But one of the many people who regularly brought unpleasant news of the deluge had told her that the company was dismantling its dispensaries to move them to where it was not raining. Then she gave up hope. She resigned herself to waiting until the rain stopped and the mail service was back to normal, and in the meantime she sought relief from her secret ailments with recourse to her imagination, because she would rather have died than put herself in the hands of the only doctor left in Macondo, the extravagant Frenchman who ate grass like a donkey. She drew close to Ursula, trusting that she would know of some palliative for her attacks. But her twisted habit of not calling things by their names made her put first things last, and use expelled for gave birth, and burning for flow, so that it would all be less shameful, with the result that Ursula reached the reasonable conclusion that her trouble was intestinal rather than uterine, and she advised her to take a dose of calomel on an empty stomach. If it had not been for that suffering, which would have had nothing shameful about it for someone who did not suffer as well from shamefulness, and if it had not been for the loss of the letters, the rain would not have bothered Fernanda, because, after all, her whole life had been spent as if it had been raining. She did not change her schedule or modify her ritual. When the table was still raised up on bricks, and the chairs put on planks, so that those at the table would not get their feet wet, she still served with linen tablecloths and fine chinaware and with lighted candles, because she felt that the calamity should not be used as a pretext for any relaxation in customs. No one went out into the street anymore. If it had depended on Fernanda, they would never have done so, not only since it started raining, but since long before that, because she felt that doors had been invented to stay closed, and that curiosity for what was going on in the street was a matter for harlots. Yet she was the first one to look out when they were told that the funeral procession for Colonel Gerineldo Marquez was passing by, and even though she only watched it through the half-opened window, it left her in such a state of affliction that for a long time she repented of her weakness. She could not have conceived of a more desolate cortege. They had put the coffin in an ox-cart, over which they built a canopy of banana leaves, but the pressure of the rain was so intense, and the street so muddy, that with every step the wheels got stuck and the covering was on the verge of falling apart. The streams of sad water that fell on the coffin were soaking the flag that had been placed on top, which was actually the flag stained with blood and gunpowder that had been rejected by more honorable veterans. On the coffin they had also placed the saber with tassels of silver and copper, the same one that Colonel Gerineldo Marquez used to hang on the coat rack in order to go into Amaranta's sewing room unarmed. Behind the cart, some barefoot, and all of them with their pants rolled up, splashing in the mud, were the last survivors of the surrender at Nilandia, carrying a drover's staff in one hand, and in the other a wreath of paper flowers that had become discolored in the rain. They appeared like an unreal vision along the street, which still bore the name of Colonel Aureliano Buendia, and they all looked at the house as they passed and turned the corner at the square, where they had to ask for help to move the cart which was stuck. Ursula had herself carried to the door by Santa Sofia de la Piedad. She followed the difficulties of the procession with such attention that no one doubted that she was seeing it, especially because her raised hand of an archangelic messenger was moving with the swaying of the cart. "Goodbye, Gerineldo, my son," she shouted. "Say hello to my people and tell them I'll see them when it stops raining." Aureliano II helped her back to bed, and with the same informality with which he always treated her, he asked her the meaning of her farewell. "It's true," she said. "I'm only waiting for the rain to stop in order to die." The condition of the streets alarmed Aureliano II. He finally became worried about the state of his animals, and he threw an oilcloth over his head and went to Petra Cotes's house. He found her in the courtyard, in the water up to her waist, trying to float the corpse of a horse. Aureliano II helped her with a lever, and the enormous swollen body gave a turn like a bell, and was dragged away by the torrent of liquid mud. Since the rain began, all that Petra Cotes had done was to clear her courtyard of dead animals. During the first weeks, she sent messages to Aureliano II for him to take urgent measures, and he had answered that there was no rush, that the situation was not alarming, that there would be plenty of time to think about something when it cleared. She sent him word that the horse pastures were being flooded, that the cattle were fleeing to high ground, where there was nothing to eat, and where they were at the mercy of jaguars and sickness. "There's nothing to be done," Aureliano II answered her. "Others will be born when it clears." Petra Cotes had seen them die in clusters, and she was able to butcher only those stuck in the mud. She saw with quiet impotence how the deluge was pitilessly exterminating a fortune that at one time was considered the largest and most solid in Macondo, and of which nothing remained but pestilence. When Aureliano II decided to go see what was going on, he found only the corpse of the horse and a squalid mule in the ruins of the stable. Petra Cotes watched him arrive without surprise, joy, or resentment, and she only allowed herself an ironic smile. "It's about time," she said. She had aged, all skin and bones, and her tapered eyes of a carnivorous animal had become sad and tame from looking at the rain so much. Aureliano Segundo stayed at her house more than 3 months, not because he felt better there than in that of his family, but because he needed all that time to make the decision to throw the piece of oilcloth back over his head. "There's no rush," he said, as he had said in the other house. "Let's hope that it clears in the next few hours." During the course of the first week, he became accustomed to the inroads that time and the rain had made in the health of his concubine, and little by little he was seeing her as she had been before, remembering her jubilant excesses and the delirious fertility that her love provoked in the animals, and partly through love, partly through interest, one night during the second week he awoke her with urgent caresses. Petrakotis did not react. "Go back to sleep," she murmured. "These aren't times for things like that." Aureliano Segundo saw himself in the mirrors on the ceiling, saw Petrakotis's spinal column like a row of spools strung together along a cluster of withered nerves. And he saw that she was right, not because of the times, but because of themselves, who were no longer up to those things. Aureliano Segundo returned home with his trunks, convinced that not only Ursula but all the inhabitants of Macondo were waiting for it to clear in order to die. He had seen them, as he passed by, sitting in their parlours with an absorbed look and folded arms, feeling unbroken time pass, relentless time, because it was useless to divide it into months and years and the days into hours, when one could do nothing but contemplate the rain. The children greeted Aureliano Segundo with excitement because he was playing the asthmatic accordion for them again, but the concerts did not attract their attention as much as the sessions with the encyclopedia, and once more they got together in Meme's room, where Aureliano Segundo's imagination changed a dirigible into a flying elephant who was looking for a place to sleep among the clouds. On one occasion he came across a man on horseback who, in spite of his strange outfit, had a familiar look, and after examining him closely, he came to the conclusion that it was a picture of Colonel Aureliano Buendía. He showed it to Fernanda, and she also admitted the resemblance of the horseman not only to the colonel, but to everybody in the family, although he was actually a Tartar warrior. Time passed in that way with the Colossus of Rhodes and snake charmers, until his wife told him that there were only 3 pounds of dried meat and a sack of rice left in the pantry. "And what do you want me to do about it?" he asked. "I don't know," Fernanda answered. "That's men's business." "Well," Aureliano Segundo said, "something will be done when it clears." He was more interested in the encyclopedia than in the domestic problem, even when he had to content himself with a scrap of meat and a little rice for lunch. "It's impossible to do anything now," he would say. "It can't rain for the rest of our lives." And while the urgencies of the pantry grew greater, Fernanda's indignation also grew, until her eventual protests, her infrequent outbursts, came forth in an uncontained, unchained torrent that began one morning like the monotonous drone of a guitar, and as the day advanced, rose in pitch, richer and more splendid. Aureliano Segundo was not aware of the sing-song until the following day after breakfast, when he felt himself being bothered by a buzzing that was by then more fluid and louder than the sound of the rain. And it was Fernanda, who was walking throughout the house complaining that they had raised her to be a queen, only to have her end up as a servant in a madhouse, with a lazy, idolatrous, libertine husband who lay on his back waiting for bread to rain down from heaven, while she was straining her kidneys, trying to keep afloat a home held together with pins, where there was so much to do, so much to bear up under and repair from the time God gave his morning sunlight until it was time to go to bed, that when she got there, her eyes were full of ground glass, and yet no one ever said to her, "Good morning, Fernanda, did you sleep well?" Nor had they asked her, even out of courtesy, why she was so pale, or why she awoke with purple rings under her eyes, in spite of the fact that she expected it, of course, from a family that had always considered her a nuisance, an old rag, a booby painted on the wall, and who were always going around saying things against her behind her back, calling her church mouse, calling her Pharisee, calling her crafty. And even Amaranta, may she rest in peace, had said aloud that she was one of those people who could not tell their rectums from their ashes. God have mercy! Such words! And she had tolerated everything with resignation because of the Holy Father, but she had not been able to tolerate it any more when that evil José Arcadio II said that the damnation of the family had come when it opened its doors to a stuck-up Highlander. Just imagine, a bossy Highlander, Lord save us, a Highland daughter of evil spit of the same stripe as the Highlanders the government sent to kill workers. You tell me, and he was referring to no one but her, the godchild of the Duke of Alba, the lady of such lineage that she made the liver of presidents' wives quiver, a noble dame of fine blood like her, who had the right to sign 11 peninsular names, and who was the only mortal creature in that town, full of bastards, who did not feel all confused at the sight of 16 pieces of silverware, so that her adulterous husband could die of laughter afterward, and say that so many knives and forks and spoons were not meant for a human being, but for a centipede, and the only one who could tell with her eyes closed when the white wine was served, and on what side, and in which glass, and when the red wine, and on what side, and in which glass, and not like that peasant of an Amaranta, may she rest in peace, who thought that white wine was served in the daytime and red wine at night, and the only one on the whole coast who could take pride in the fact that she took care of her bodily needs only in golden chamber pots, so that Colonel Aureliano Buendia, may he rest in peace, could have the effrontery to ask her, with his Masonic ill-humour, where she had received that privilege, and whether she did not shit shit, but shat sweet basil. Just imagine, with those very words, and so that Renata, her own daughter, who, through an oversight, had seen her stool in the bedroom, had answered that even if the pot was all gold and with a coat of arms, what was inside was pure shit, physical shit, and worse even than any other kind, because it was stuck-up Highland shit. Just imagine, her own daughter, so that she never had any illusions about the rest of the family. But in any case, she had the right to expect a little more consideration from her husband, because, for better or for worse, he was her consecrated spouse, her helpmate, her legal despoiler, who took upon himself, of his own free and sovereign will, the grave responsibility of taking her away from her paternal home, where she never wanted for or suffered from anything, where she wove funeral wreaths as a pastime, since her godfather had sent a letter with his signature and the stamp of his ring on the sealing wax, simply to say that the hands of his goddaughter were not meant for tasks of this world, except to play the clavichord. And nevertheless, her insane husband had taken her from her home with all manner of admonitions and warnings, and had brought her to that frying pan of hell, where a person could not breathe because of the heat. And before she had completed her Pentecostal fast, he had gone off with his wandering trunks and his wastrel's accordion to loaf in adultery with a wretch of whom it was only enough to see her behind. Well, that's been said, to see her wiggle her mare's behind in order to guess that she was, just the opposite of her, who was a lady in a palace or a pigsty, at the table or in bed, a lady of breeding, God-fearing, obeying his laws and submissive to his wishes, and with whom he could not perform, naturally, the acrobatics and trampish antics that he did with the other one, who, of course, was ready for anything, like the French matrons, and even worse, if one considers, well, because they at least had the honesty to put a red light at their door, swinishness like that, just imagine, and that was all that was needed by the only and beloved daughter of Doña Renata Argote and Don Fernando del Carpio, and especially the latter, an upright man, a fine Christian, a knight of the Order of the Holy Sepulchre, those who receive direct from God the privilege of remaining intact in their graves, with their skin smooth like the cheeks of a bride, and their eyes alive and clear like emeralds. That's not true, Aureliano Secundo interrupted her. He was already beginning to smell when they brought him here. He had the patience to listen to her for a whole day, until he caught her in a slip. Fernanda did not pay him any mind, but she lowered her voice. That night at dinner, the exasperating buzzing of the sing-song had conquered the sound of the rain. Aureliano Segundo ate very little, with his head down, and he went to his room early. At breakfast on the following day, Fernando was trembling, with a look of not having slept well, and she seemed completely exhausted by her rancor. Nevertheless, when her husband asked if it was not possible to have a soft-boiled egg, she did not answer simply that they had run out of eggs the week before, but she worked up a violent diatribe against men who spent their time contemplating